The Great Satan. Roger sits in the bar in the King David Hotel, drinking from a tall glass of second-rate lemonade and sweating in spite of the air conditioning. He's dizzy and disoriented from jet lag. The gut cramps have only let him come down from his room in the past hour, and he has another 2 hours to go before he can try to place a call to Andrea. They had another blazing row before he flew out here. She doesn't understand why he keeps having to visit odd corners of the globe. She only knows that his son is growing up thinking a father is a voice that phones at odd times of day. Roger is mildly depressed, despite the buzz of doing business at this level. He spends a lot of time worrying about what'll happen if they're found out. What will Andrea do, or Jason, for that matter? Jason, whose father is a phone call away all the time. If Roger is led away in handcuffs beneath the glare of flashbulbs, if the colonel sings, if the shy, bald admiral is browbeaten into spilling the beans to Congress, who will look after them then? Roger has no illusions about what kills black operations. There are too many people in the loop. Too many elaborate front corporations and numbered bank accounts and shady Middle Eastern arms dealers. Sooner or later, someone will find a reason to talk, and Roger is in too deep. He isn't just the company liaison officer anymore, he's become the colonel's bagman, his shadow, the guy with the diplomatic passport and the bulging briefcase full of heroin and end-user certificates. At least the ship will sink from the top down, he thinks. There are people very high up who want the colonel to succeed. When the shit hits the fan and is sprayed across the front page of the Washington Post, it'll likely take down cabinet members and secretaries of state. The president himself will have to take the witness stand and deny everything. The republic will question itself. A hand descends on his shoulder, sharply cutting off his reverie.
Howdy, Roger. What you worrying about now?
Jorgensen looks up wearily. Stuff, he says, gloomily. Have a seat. The redneck from the embassy, Mike Hamilton, some kind of junior attaché for embassy protocol by cover, pulls out a chair and crashes down on it like a friendly car wreck. He's not really a redneck. Roger knows rednecks don't come with doctorates in foreign relations from Yale, but he likes people to think he's a bumpkin when he needs to get something from them.
He's early,
says Hamilton, looking past Roger's ear, voice suddenly all business. Play the agenda. I'm your dim but friendly good cop. Got the background? Deniables ready? Roger nods, then glances round and sees Mehmet, family name unknown, approaching from the other side of the room. Mehmet is impeccably manicured and tailored, wearing a suit from Jermyn Street that costs more than Roger earns in a month. He has a neatly trimmed beard and moustache and talks with a pronounced English accent. Mehmet is a Turkish name, not a Persian one. Pseudonym, of course. To look at him, you'd think he was a westernized Turkish businessman, certainly not an Iranian revolutionary with heavy links to Hezbollah and, whisper this, old man Ruhollah himself, the hermit of Qom. Never in 1,000 years, the unofficial Iranian ambassador to the little Satan in Tel Aviv. Mehmet strides over. A brief exchange of pleasantries masks the essential formality of their meeting. He's early, a deliberate move to put them off balance. He's outnumbered, too, and that's also a move to put them on the defensive, because the first rule of diplomacy is never to put yourself in a negotiating situation where the other side can assert any kind of moral authority, and sheer weight of numbers is a powerful psychological tool.
Roger, my dear fellow.
He smiles at Jorgensen.
And the charming Dr. Hamilton, I see.
The smile broadens.
I take it the good colonel is desirous of news of his friends.
Jorgensen nods. That is indeed the case. Mehmet stops smiling. For a moment he looks 10 years older.
I visited them,
he says shortly.
No, I was taken to see them.
It is indeed grave, my friends. They are in the hands of very dangerous men, men who have nothing to lose and are filled with hatred.
Roger speaks.
There is a debt between us. Mehmet holds up a hand.
Peace, my friend. We will come to that. These are men of violence, men who have seen their homes destroyed and families subjected to indignities, and their hearts are full of anger. It will take a large display of repentance, a high blood price to buy their acquiescence. That is part of our law, you understand. The family of the bereaved may demand blood price of the transgressor, and how else might the world be? They see it in these terms, that you must repent of your evils and assist them in waging holy war against those who would defile the will of Allah.
Roger sighs.
We do what we can, he says. We're shipping them arms. We're fighting the Soviets every way we can without provoking the big one. What more do they want? The hostages, that's not playing well in D.C. There's got to be some give and take. If Hezbollah doesn't release them soon, they'll just convince everyone that they're not serious about negotiating. And that'll be an end to it. The colonel wants to help you, but he's got to have something to show the man at the top, right?
Mehmet nods.
You and I are men of the world and understand that this keeping of hostages is not rational, but they look to you for defense against the other great Satan that assails them and their blood burns with anger that your nation, for all its fine words, takes no action. The great Satan rampages in Afghanistan, taking whole villages by night, and what is done? The United States turns its back. And they are not the only ones who feel betrayed. Our Ba'athist foes from Iraq. In Basra, the unholy brotherhood of Tikrit and their servants, the Mukhabarat, hold nightly sacrifice upon the altar of Yair Sutoth. The fountains of blood in Tehran testify to their effect. If the richest, most powerful nation on earth refuses to fight, these men of violence from the Bekaa think, how may we unstopper the ears of that nation? And they are not sophisticates, like you or I.
He looks at Roger, who hunches his shoulders uneasily.
We can't move against the Soviets openly. They must understand that. It would be the end of far more than their little war. If the Taliban want American help against the Russians, it cannot be delivered openly.
It's not the Russians that we quarrel with, Mehmet says quietly, but their choice in allies. They believe themselves to be infidel atheists, but by their deeds they shall be known. The icy spore of Leng is upon them. Their tools are those described in the Kitab al-Azif. We have proof that they have violated the terms of the Dresden Agreement. The accursed and unhallowed stalk the frozen passes of the Himalayas by night, taking all whose path they cross. And will you stopper your ears, even as the Russians grow in misplaced confidence, sure that their dominance of these forces of evil is complete? The gates are opening everywhere, as it was prophesied. Last week we flew an F-14C with a camera relay pod through one of them. The pilot and weapons operator are in paradise now, but we have glanced into hell and have the film and radar plots to prove it. The Iranian ambassador fixes the redneck from the embassy with an icy gaze. Tell your ambassador that we have opened preliminary discussions with Mossad, with a view to purchasing the produce of a factory at Dimona in the Negev. Past insults may be set aside, for the present danger imperils all of us. They are receptive to our arguments, even if you are not. His Holiness, the Ayatollah, has declared in private that any warrior who carries a nuclear device into the abode of the Eater of Souls will certainly achieve paradise. There will be an end to the followers of the ancient abominations on this earth, Dr. Hamilton, even if we have to push the nuclear bombs down their throats with our own hands. Swimming pool.
Mr. Jorgensen, at what point did you become aware that the Iranian government was threatening to violate UN Resolution 216 and the Non-Proliferation Protocol to the 1956 Geneva Accords?
Roger sweats under the hot lights. His heartbeat accelerates.
I'm not sure I understand the question, sir. I asked you a direct question. Which part don't you understand? I'm going to repeat myself slowly. When did you realize that the Iranian government was threatening to violate Resolution 216 and the 1956 Geneva Accords on nuclear proliferation?
Roger shakes his head. It's like a bad dream. Unseen insects buzzing furiously around him.
Sir, I had no direct dealings with the Iranian government. All I know is that I was asked to carry messages to and from a guy called Mehmet, who, I was told, knew something about our hostages in Beirut. My understanding is that the colonel has been conducting secret negotiations with this gentleman, or his backers, for some time, a couple of years now.
Mehmet made allusions to parties in the Iranian administration, but I have no way of knowing if he was telling the truth, and I never saw any diplomatic credentials.
There's an inquisition of dark-suited congressmen opposite him, like a jury of teachers sitting in judgment over an errant pupil. The trouble is, these teachers can put him in front of a judge and send him to prison for many years, so that Jason really will grow up with a father who's a voice on the telephone, a father who isn't around to take him to air shows or ball games or any of the other rituals of growing up. They're talking to each other quietly, deciding on another line of questioning. Roger shifts uneasily in his chair. This is a closed hearing, the television camera a gesture in the direction of the congressional archives. A pack of hungry Democrats have scented Republican blood in the water. The congressman in the middle looks toward Roger.
Stop right there. Where did you know about this guy Mehmet from? Who told you to go see him? And who told you what he was?
Roger swallows. I got a memo from Fawn, like always. Admiral Poindexter wanted a man on the spot to talk to this guy. A messenger, basically, was already in the loop. Colonel North signed off on it and told me to charge the trip to his discretionary fund.
That must have been the wrong thing to say, because two of the congressmen are leaning together and whispering in each other's ears, and an aide obligingly sidles up to accept a note, then dashes away.
I was told that Mehmet was a mediator.
Roger adds, in trying to resolve the Beirut hostage thing.
A mediator?
The guy asking the questions looks at him in disbelief. The man to his left, who looks as old as the moon, thin white hair, liver spots on his hooked nose, eyelids like sacks, chuckles appreciatively.
Yeah, like Hitler was a diplomat.
One more territorial demand.
He glances round.
Nobody else remember that?
He asks plaintively.
No, sir, Roger says. Very seriously. The prime interrogator snorts.
What did Mehmet tell you Iran was going to do, exactly?
Roger thinks for a moment.
He said they were going to buy something from a factory at Dimona. I understood this to be the Israeli Defense Ministry's Nuclear Weapons Research Institute, and the only logical item, in the context of our discussion, was a nuclear weapon, or weapons. He said the Ayatollah had decreed that a suicide bomber who took out the temple of Yog-Sothoth in Basra would achieve paradise, and that they also had hard evidence that the Soviets have deployed certain illegal weapon systems in Afghanistan. This was in the context of discussing illegal weapons proliferation. He was very insistent about the Iraq thing.
What exactly are these weapons systems?
Demands the third inquisitor, a quiet, hawk-faced man sitting on the left of the panel.
The Shagar team, they call them, as servitors.
There are several kinds of advanced robotic systems made out of molecular components. They can change shape, restructure material at the atomic level, act like corrosive acid or secrete diamonds. Some of them are like a tenuous mist, what Dr. Drexler at MIT calls a utility fog, while others are more like an oily globule. Apparently, they may be able to manufacture more of themselves, but they're not really alive in any meaning of the term we're familiar with. They're programmable, like robots, using a command language deduced from recovered records of the forerunners who left them here. The Molotov raid of 1930 brought back a large consignment of them. All we have to go on are the scraps they missed and reports by the Antarctic Survey. Professor Liebkunst's files in particular are most frustrating. Stop. So you're saying the Russians have these, shuggles, but we don't have any? And even those dumb Arab bastards in Baghdad are working on them? So you're saying we've got a Shoggoth gap, a strategic chink in our armor, and now the Iranians say the Russians are using them in Afghanistan? Roger speaks rapidly. That is minimally correct, sir, although countervailing weapons have been developed to reduce the risk of a unilateral preemption escalating to an exchange of weakly godlike agencies. The congressman in the middle nods encouragingly. For the past 3 decades, the B-39 Peacemaker Force has been tasked by PSYOP with maintaining an XK Pluto capability directed at ablating the ability of the Russians to activate Project Cachet, the dormant alien entity they captured from the Nazis at the end of the last war. We have 12 Pluto-class atomic-powered cruise missiles pointed at that thing day and night, as many megatons as the entire Minuteman force. In principle, we will be able to blast it to pieces before it can be brought to full wakefulness and eat the minds of everyone within 200 miles. He warms to his subject. Secondly, we believe the Soviet control of Shoggoth technology is rudimentary at best. They know how to tell them to roll over an Afghan hill farmer village, but they can't manufacture more of them. Their utility as weapons is limited but terrifying, but they're not much of a problem. A greater issue is the temple in Basra. This contains an operational gateway, and according to Mehmet, the Iraqi political secret police, the Mukhabarat, are trying to figure out how to manipulate it. They're trying to summon something through it. He seemed to be mostly afraid that they, and the Russians, would lose control of whatever it was. Presumably, another weakly godlike creature like the K'Thulu entity at the core of Project Cachet. The old guy speaks. This Fulu thing, boy, you can drop those stupid K prefixes around me. Is it one of a kind? Roger shakes his head. I don't know, sir. We know the gateway is linked to at least 3 other planets. There may be many that we don't know of. We don't know how to create them or close them. All we can do is send people through or pile bricks in the opening. He nearly bites his tongue, because there are more than 3 worlds out there, and he's been to at least one of them, the bolt hole on XK Masada, built by the NRO from their secret budget. He's seen the mile-high dome Buckminster Fuller spent his last decade designing for them, the rings of Patriot air defense missiles, a squadron of black diamond-shaped fighters from the Skunk Works, said to be invisible to radar, patrols the empty skies of XK Masada. Hydroponic farms and empty barracks and apartment blocks await the senators and congressmen and their families and thousands of support personnel. In event of war, they'll be evacuated through the small gate that has been moved to the executive office building basement, in a room beneath the swimming pool, where Jack used to go skinny-dipping with Marilyn. Off the record now, the old congressman waves his hand in a chopping gesture. I say, off, boy! The cameraman switches off his machine and leaves. He leans forward toward Roger. What you're telling me is we've been waging a secret war since... When?
The end of the Second World War? Earlier? The Peabody Antarctic Expedition in the 20s, whose survivors brought back the first of these alien relics? And now the Iranians have gotten into the game and figure it's part of their fight with Saddam?
Sir, Roger barely trusts himself to do more than nod.
Well, the congressman eyes his neighbor sharply. Let me put it to you that you have heard the phrase, the great filter. What does it mean to you?
The great... Roger stops. Professor Gould, he thinks.
We had a professor of paleontology lecture us, he explains. I think he mentioned it, something about why there aren't any aliens in flying saucers buzzing us the whole time.
The congressman snorts. His neighbor starts and sits up.
Thanks to Peabody and his followers, Liebkunst and the like, we know there's a lot of life in the universe. The great filter, boy, is whatever force stops most of it developing intelligence and coming to visit. Something, somehow, kills intelligent species before they develop this kind of technology for themselves. How about meddling with relics of the Elder Ones? What do you think of that?
Roger licks his lips nervously.
That sounds like a good possibility, sir, he says. His unease is building.
The congressman's expression is intense.
These weapons your colonel is dicking around with makes all our nukes look like a toy bow and arrow, and all you can say is it's a good possibility, sir? Seems to me like someone in the Oval Office has been asleep at the switch.
Sir, Executive Order 2047, issued January 1980, directed the armed forces to standardize on nuclear weapons to fill the mass destruction role. All other items were to be developmentally suspended, with surplus stocks allocated to the supervision of Admiral Poindexter's Joint Munitions Expenditure Committee, which Colonel North was detached to by the USMC High Command, with the full cognizance of the White House. The door opens. The congressman looks round angrily.
I thought I said we weren't to be disturbed.
The aide standing there looks uncertain. Sir, there's been an major security incident, and we need to evacuate.
Where? What happened?
Demands the congressman. But Roger, with a sinking feeling, realizes that the aide isn't watching the House committee members and the guy behind him, his Secret Service.
Basra, there's been an attack, sir.
A furtive glance at Roger as his brain freezes in denial. If you'd all please come this way.
Bombing in 15 minutes.
Heads down through a corridor where congressional staffers hurry about carrying papers, urgently calling one another. A cadre of dark-suited Secret Service agents closes in, hustling Roger along in the wake of the committee members. A wailing like tinnitus fills his ears. What's happening, he asks, but nobody answers. Down into the basement, another corridor where two Marine guards are waiting with drawn weapons. The Secret Service guys are exchanging terse reports by radio. The committee men are hurried away along a narrow service tunnel. Roger is stalled by the entrance.
What's going on? He asks his minder.
Just a moment, sir. More listening. These guys cock their heads to one side as they take instruction, birds of prey scanning the horizon for targets.
Delta IV coming in. Over. You're clear to go along the tunnel now, sir, this way.
What's happening? Roger demands as they rush him into the corridor, along to the end and round a sharp corner. Numb shock takes hold. He keeps putting one foot in front of the other.
We're now at DEFCON 1, sir. You're down on the special list as part of the House staff. Next door on the left, sir.
The queue, in the dim-lit basement room is moving fast, white-gloved guards with clipboards checking off men and a few women in suits as they step through a steel blast door one by one and disappear from view. Roger looks round in bewilderment. He sees a familiar face. Fawn, what's going on? The secretary looks puzzled. I don't know, Roger. I thought you were testifying today.
So did I.
They're at the door.
What else?
Ronnie was making a big speech in Helsinki. The colonel had me record it in his office, something about not coexisting with the empire of evil. He cracked some kind of joke about how we start bombing in 15 minutes, then this.
They're at the door. It opens on a steel-walled airlock, and the Marine Guard is taking their badges and waving them inside. Two staff types and a middle-aged brigadier join them, and the door thumps shut. The background noise vanishes. Roger's ears pop, then the inner door opens, and another Marine Guard waves them through into the receiving hall.
Where are we?
Asks the big-haired secretary, staring around.
Welcome to XK Masada, says Roger.
Then his childhood horrors catch up with him, and he goes in search of a toilet to throw up in.
We need you back.
Roger spends the next week in a state of numbed shock. His apartment here is like a small hotel room. A hotel with security, air conditioning, and windows that only open onto an interior atrium. He pays little attention to his surroundings. It's not as if he has a home to return to. Roger stops shaving, stops changing his socks, stops looking in mirrors or combing his hair. He smokes a lot, orders cheap bourbon from the commissary, and drinks himself into an amnesic stupor each night. He's frankly a mess, self-destructive. Everything disintegrated under him at once. His job, the people he held in high regard, his family, his life. All the time he can't get one thing out of his head. The expression on Gorman's face as he stands there, in front of the submarine, rotting from the inside out with radiation sickness, dead, and not yet knowing it. It's why he's stopped looking in mirrors. On the fourth day, he's slumped in a chair, watching taped I Love Lucy reruns on the boob tube, when the door to his suite opens quietly. Someone comes in. He doesn't look round until the colonel walks across the screen and unplugs the TV set at the wall, then sits down in the chair next to him. The colonel has bags of dark skin under his eyes. His jacket is rumpled and his collar is unbuttoned.
You gotta stop this, Roger, he says quietly. You look like shit.
Yeah, well, you too. The colonel passes him a slim manila folder. Without wanting to, Roger slides out the single sheet of paper within.
So it was them.
Yeah.
A moment's silence.
For what it's worth, we haven't lost yet. We may yet pull your wife and son out alive, or be able to go back home.
Your family too, I suppose.
Roger is touched by the colonel's consideration, the pious hope that Andrea and Jason will be all right even through his shell of misery.
He realizes his glass is empty. Instead of refilling it, he puts it down on the carpet beside his feet.
Why?
The colonel removes the sheet of paper from his numb fingers.
Probably someone spotted you in the King David and traced you back to us. The Mukhabarat had agents everywhere, and if they were in league with the KGB...
He shrugs.
Things escalated rapidly. Then the president cracked that joke over a hot mic that was supposed to be switched off. Have you been checking in with the desk summaries this week?
Roger looks at him blankly.
Should I? Oh, things are still happening.
The colonel leans back and stretches his feet out.
From what we can tell of the situation on the other side, not everyone's dead yet. Legachev screaming blue murder over the hotline, accusing us of genocide, but he's still talking. Europe is a mess, and nobody knows what's going on in the Middle East.
Even the blackbirds aren't making it back out again.
The thing at Tikrit?
Yeah, it's bad news, Roger. We need you back.
Bad news?
The worst.
The colonel jams his hands between his knees, stares at the floor like a bashful child.
Saddam Hussein al-Tikriti spent years trying to get his hands on Elder technology. It looks like he finally succeeded in stabilizing the gate into Sothoth.
Whole villages disappeared. Marsh Arabs wiped out in the swamps of eastern Iraq. Reports of yellow rain, people's skin melting right off their bones. The Iranians got itchy and finally went nuclear. Trouble is, they did so 2 hours before that speech. Some asshole in Plotsk launched half the Uralskaya SS-20 grid. They went to launch on warning 8 months ago, burning south. Praise Jesus. Scratch the Middle East, period. Everything from the Nile to the Khyber Pass is toast. We're still waiting for the callback on Moscow, but SAC has put the whole peacemaker force on airborne alert. So far, we've lost the eastern seaboard as far south as northern Virginia, and they've lost the Donbass Basin and Vladivostok. Things are a mess. Nobody can even agree whether we're fighting the commies or something else. But the box at Chernobyl, Project Cochet, the doors are open, Roger. We orbited a keyhole 11 over it, and there are tracks leading west. The Pluto strike didn't stop it, and nobody knows what the fuck is going on in Warpack country, or France, or Germany, or Japan, or England. The colonel makes a grab for Roger's wild turkey, rubs the neck clean, and swallows from the bottle. He looks at Roger with a wild expression on his face. Cochet is loose, Roger. They fucking woke the thing, and now they can't control it. Can you believe that?
I can believe that. I want you back behind a desk tomorrow morning, Roger. We need to know what this Thulu creature is capable of. We need to know what to do to stop it. Forget Iraq. Iraq is a smoking hole in the map. But K. Thulu is heading toward the Atlantic coast. What are we going to do if it doesn't stop?
Masada. The city of XK Masada sprouts like a vast mushroom, a mile-wide dome emerging from the top of a cold plateau on a dry planet that orbits a dying star. The jagged black shapes of F-117s howl across the empty skies outside it at dusk and dawn, patrolling the threatening emptiness that stretches as far as the mind can imagine. Shadows move in the streets of the city, hollowed-out human shells in uniform. They rustle around the feet of the towering concrete blocks like the dry leaves of autumn, obsessively focused on the tasks that lend structure to their remaining days. Above them tower masts of steel, propping up the huge geodesic dome that arches across the sky, blocking out the hostile, alien constellations, protecting frail humanity from the dust storms that periodically scour the bones of the ancient world. The gravity here is a little lighter. The night sky whorled and marbled by the diaphanous sheets of gas blasted off the dying star that lights their days. During the long winter nights, a flurry of carbon dioxide snow dusts the surface of the dome, but the air is bone dry. The city slaking its thirst on subterranean aquifers. This planet was once alive. There is still a scummy sea of algae near the equator that feeds oxygen into the atmosphere, and there is a range of volcanoes near the North Pole that speaks of plate tectonics in motion. But it is visibly dying. There's a lot of history here, but no future. Sometimes, in the early hours when he cannot sleep, Roger walks outside the city, along the edge of the dry plateau. Machines labor on behind him, keeping the city tenuously intact.
He pays them little attention. There is talk of mounting an expedition to Earth one of these years to salvage whatever is left before the searing winds of time erase it forever. Roger doesn't like to think about that. He tries to avoid thinking about Earth as much as possible, except when he cannot sleep, but walks along the cliff top, prodding at memories of Andrea and Jason and his parents and sister and relatives and friends, each of them as painful as the socket of a missing tooth. He has a mouthful of emptiness, bitter and aching out here on the edge of the plateau. Sometimes Roger thinks he's the last human being alive. He works in an office, feverishly trying to sort out what went wrong, and bodies move around him, talking, eating in the canteen, sometimes talking to him, and waiting, as if they expect a dialogue. There are bodies here, men and some women, chatting, civilian and some military, but no people. One of the bodies, an army surgeon, told him he's suffering from a common stress disorder, survivor's guilt. This may be so, Roger admits, but it doesn't change anything. Soulless days follow sleepless nights into oblivion, dust trickling over the side of the cliff like sand into the undug graves of his family. A narrow path runs along the side of the plateau, just downhill from the foundations of the city power plant, where huge apertures belch air warmed by the radiators of the nuclear reactor. Roger follows the path, gravel and sandy rock crunching under his worn shoes. Foreign stars twinkle overhead, forming unrecognizable patterns that tell him he's far from home. The trail drops away from the top of the plateau, until the city is an unseen shadow, looming above and behind his shoulder. To his right is a dizzying panorama. The huge rift valley with its ancient city of the dead stretched out before him. Beyond it rise alien mountains, their peaks as high and airless as the dead volcanoes of Mars. About half a mile away from the dome, the trail circles an outcrop of rock and takes a downhill switchback turn. Roger stops at the bend and looks out across the desert at his feet. He sits down, leans against the rough cliff face and stretches his legs out across the path so that his feet dangle over nothingness. Far below him, the dead valley is furrowed with rectangular depressions. Once, millions of years ago, they might have been fields, but nothing like that survives to this date. They're just dead, like everyone else on this world. Like Roger. In his shirt pocket, a crumpled, precious pack of cigarettes. He pulls a white cylinder out with shaking fingers, sniffs at it, then flicks his lighter under it. Scarcity has forced him to cut back. He coughs at the first lungful of stale smoke, a harsh, racking croak. The irony of being saved from lung cancer by a world war is not lost on him. He blows smoke out, a tenuous trail streaming across the cliff. "Why me?" he asks quietly. The emptiness takes its time answering. When it does, it speaks with the colonel's voice. "You know the reason." "I didn't want to do it," he hears himself saying. "I didn't want to leave them behind." The void laughs at him. There are miles of empty air beneath his dangling feet. "You had no choice." "Yes, I did. I didn't have to come here." He pauses. "I didn't have to do anything," he says quietly, and inhales another lungful of death. "It was all automatic. Maybe it was inevitable." "Evitable," echoes the distant horizon. Something dark and angular skims across the stars like an echo of extinct pterosaurs. turbofans whirring within its belly, the F-117 hunts on, patrolling to keep at bay the ancient evil, unaware that the battle is already lost.
Your family could still be alive, you know.
He looks up. They could? Andrea? Jason? Alive? The void laughs again, unfriendly.
There is life eternal within the Eater of Souls. Nobody is ever forgotten or allowed to rest in peace. They populate the simulation spaces of its mind, exploring all the possible alternative endings to their lives. There is a fate worse than death, you know.
Roger looks at his cigarette disbelievingly, throws it far out into the night sky above the plane. He watches it fall until its ember is no longer visible. Then he gets up. For a long moment he stands poised on the edge of the cliff, nerving himself and thinking. Then he takes a step back, turns, and slowly makes his way back up the trail toward the redoubt on the plateau. If his analysis of the situation is wrong, at least he is still alive. And if he is right, dying would be no escape. He wonders why hell is so cold at this time of year.
This ends A Colder War, narrated by Paul Hecht. This wasn't originally going to be an H.P. Lovecraft tribute story, honest. It was going to be about alienation and inhumanity when I started writing it in 1997. But I happened to be rereading At the Mountains of Madness at the time, and purely by coincidence caught a documentary on TV that featured one of those sinister May Day parades through Moscow, with the ranks of tanks and infantry carriers rumbling through Red Square. I couldn't help sketching in a vision of low loaders like tank transporters, burdened with something amorphous, barely glimpsed beneath a tarpaulin, rolling past the review stand, and all at once I was left wondering, what kind of present day would Professor Peabody's Antarctic expedition have led to? Nothing good, that's for sure. A couple of years later, some of the questions raised by this story came back to haunt me in a different context as I began writing The Atrocity Archive. But I can't maintain that level of existential bleakness at greater length, which is probably a good thing.